CFUV 101.9 FM broadcasts from the Songhees and Wasanich territories, also known as Victoria, BC. You can listen to our music, spoken word, and multicultural programs anywhere, anytime at cfuv.ca.
This program reflects the views and opinions of the participants and not necessarily those of CFUV. Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded February 5th, 2022. While war and rumors of war are filling the headlines and lead news broadcasts, whether stories in the press are about a war recently passed and its aftermath, like in Afghanistan, or a feared future war, as featured by sabers rattling over Ukraine, what seems inescapable is war, war ever present. This is perfectly illustrated in Afghanistan, where the end of war brings no peace, and in Ukraine, where the killing and dying long preceded the rumor of fighting to come. So what's left to do but work for peace, and keep on working for peace? Kathy Kelly is a longtime peace and justice activist, essayist, author, and recipient of numerous awards for her peace service, including multiple nominations for the Nobel Peace Prize. She's a founding member of Voices in the Wilderness and Voices for Creative Nonviolence, co-authored the book Prisoners on Purpose, A Peacemaker's Guide to Jails and Prison, and wrote Other Lands Have Dreams, From Baghdad to Pekin Prison. Kelly has made numerous trips to Afghanistan as an invited guest and lived alongside ordinary Afghans in working-class Kabul. Kathy Kelly in the first half, and American and Canadian efforts to bring diplomatic and military pressure to bear on Russia over Ukraine may seem a mystery to those in the West who rarely receive context with their newspapers or as part of their nightly newscasts. Ivan Kachanovsky is a scholar, essayist, and author teaching at the School of Political Studies at the University of Ottawa. He's the author of Cleft Countries, Regional Political Divisions and Cultures in Post-Soviet Ukraine and Moldova. Ivan Kachanovsky and returning to Maidan to unwind the true origin story behind the current Ukraine-Russia conflict. But first, Kathy Kelly and the war not over in Afghanistan. Well, welcome back to the program, Kathy.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be back on Guerrilla Radio.
Well, it's always my great privilege to speak with you, of course. Now, Kathy, what are you hearing from your friends and contacts about the situation in Afghanistan right now?
Well, there's been a marked alarm and panic that has shot up because of the economic dilemma that people face. I have never before received letters from young people I knew who were part of, you know, the activism, saying my neighbor knocked on the door and her child has died of hypothermia. People in refugee camps did face those risks, but generally people who were, you know, living in, you know, the kinds of neighborhoods where these young friends are, you know, maybe working class neighborhoods, but people were not so desperate for bread and for fuel as is now happening across the country. And of course, that's a natural, predictable, and terrible, maddening consequence of what the United States has done in freezing Afghanistan's assets. It's interesting that we've been trying also to help some people who are fleeing for their lives because they feel they're at extreme risk because of the profile that they had in the past, sometimes working maybe not even employed, but volunteering with Westerners, or people who had, you know, been on internet, being part of protests of Taliban attacks in the past. But, you know, what we've been told is people are kind of marooned and stuck in various situations by the UNHCR. What the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission of Refugees, has told us is one of the most important things you can do is keep Afghanistan in front of people's eyes through the media. Keep telling the media about concerns for Afghanistan, because if it slips off the radar, then these terrible economic repercussions of the United States having frozen Afghanistan's assets, I mean, we're talking about $9.4 billion that's been confiscated by the United States government and frozen. then that economy will collapse. So this is maddening, I believe, because we've seen this story before. You know, we saw what happened when economic sanctions afflicted Iraq, and it was the mothers and the children primarily who suffered.
I think when we first, you and I spoke, Kathy, it was when you were with Voices in the Wilderness and setting up going to Iraq before the second Gulf War there, because in protest of sanctions that were killing, by some estimates, 500,000 Iraqi children.
Well, in 1996, the United Nations had calculated that at that point, just counting the little children under age 5, they believed that 500,000 children had died, and those deaths were a direct result of the economic sanctions. And, you know, I think it's important to recognize that when children become malnourished, then they're vulnerable to all kinds of other respiratory and gastrointestinal diseases. So, you know, somebody might say, well, that wasn't because of food. But, you know, when you don't have food and you don't have medicine and you don't have money and there's tremendous cold, children cannot survive that. So they're now talking about 1 million children in Afghanistan unlikely to survive these terrible months with the assets frozen and the winter weather having arrived. And 22.8 million people are experiencing acute food insecurity right now. That's 55% of the population.
Well, Mark Weisbrot, he's writing under a byline of InsideStories.com. He's got a piece up that says sanctions on Afghanistan could be deadlier than 20 years of war. And he mentions the $9 plus billion in sanctions against the central bank in Afghanistan. And that represents one half of the entire economy of the country, he says.
Well, yeah. And then when the central banks don't function, the chaos is terrible. I mean, This is anecdotal, but I've been trying to help get small amounts of money to people in very desperate need amongst people we've known personally. And, you know, 1 week, Western Union is down completely. And then the next week you hear, well, you can't send more than $400. And then you hear, well, you can send anything you want, but only one transfer per month. The banking system is in a chaos. And also, you know, their currency is somewhat pegged to the United States dollar. So this will lead to such a collapse in the economy. People like doctors and teachers and nurses and infrastructure maintenance people haven't been paid for 14 months. And if the United States thinks this is going to hurt the Taliban leadership, I think it's so ironic because they're saying, oh, the Taliban leadership might hurt the women and girls. And so we're going to punish them to death, starve them to death.
Well, and this is on top of the fact that the local currency has been in free fall as well. And inflation, if we think inflation is bad here, it's pushing food and other essential commodities beyond the price of even those Afghans who have money in the basement or under the mattress.
Well, for instance, when I was, I guess I made about, 27, maybe more visits to Afghanistan between 2010, 2020. And I can tell you, breakfast never varied. You got up in the morning and these young friends would sit down in a circle of 8 or 9 and somebody would have nipped out to get 4 wheels, like, you know, large wheels of flatbread. And it was delicious. It was fresh. And they would share that equitably. And that was breakfast. I mean, there was never any, you know, big indulgence on the part of these kids. But now that same wheel is twice as expensive. So if you were splitting a wheel of bread between 4 people, now it has to be split between 8. And that's going to be true of the lentils and rice that people might be able to eke out an existence on over the lunch meal. People are hungry and panicked. What will they do?
Well, Weisbrot also says that there's some recognition of this in the U.S. Congress and some pushback. He writes that there's 4 dozen Congress representatives have sent a letter to the president saying, quote, that the U.S. confiscation of the $9.4 billion in Afghanistan's currency reserves is plunging the country, quote, deeper into economic and humanitarian crisis. Help me understand, Kathy, by dint of what right does the American government claim they are able to levy these sanctions against Afghanistan? Why are they punished like this after all that they've been through already?
Well, the United States was fighting the Taliban for many years, during which it said it would not recognize the Taliban as a group that could be considered a governing group. And at this point, that's still the case. The United States doesn't recognize the Taliban as the government, the official government. So why would they then free up money to a group that's not recognized as the government? It's true now that the European Union is beginning diplomatic relations. Other embassies are beginning to open up. I think the Taliban probably can appeal to China and to Russia and get support for their government. And that's why it's so inscrutable. Why should the United States pursue a policy that's going to hurt primarily women and children and refugees and sick people and old people, vulnerable people, who really don't have much of an ability to overthrow this government? Now, it's true, it's not an elected government, but in this crisis situation, it's not going to be enough to say, oh, well, we'll get some more humanitarian aid in there. Because if the economy collapses, then you can't continue to sustain an entire country with humanitarian aid. So Biden actually, and Mark Weisbrot certainly says this clearly, with the stroke of a pen, he could reverse this situation. And it seems to me it's a critical need. You know, we saw with the economic sanctions against Iraq that if you wanted to eventually overthrow a ruthless and a brutal dictatorship, which Saddam Hussein's dictatorship certainly was, then the best thing to do was to strengthen social services, strengthen education, and prevent the country from becoming isolated from the rest of the world. Sanctions do the opposite. They ruin civil services. They ruin education because the educators aren't going to be paid and the infrastructure won't be maintained. And for instance, Afghanistan is an agricultural country, and if farmers grow food and then can't sell it, they're going to stop trying to cultivate the land. So then you can imagine the poppy crops will become even more prevalent as a part of the economy. And then you move into being more of a narco state, a failed narco state with a collapsing economy. But, you know, should the United States say, and we were responsible for driving this because we stole, basically confiscated, $9.4 billion of the desperately needed assets in that country?
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today to Kathy Kelly. Kathy is a longtime peace and justice activist. She's an essayist, author, recipient of numerous awards for her peace service, including multiple nominations to the Nobel Peace Prize. She's written the book Prisoners on Purpose, A Peacemaker's Guide to Jails and Prison, and also Other Lands Have Dreams, from Baghdad to Pekin Prison. What effect do these sanctions have on people, regular people like you and I, Kathy, trying to get aid into the country?
Well, you know, I have a friend who's a professor. He's an Afghan, had actually taught for 6 years at the American University of Afghanistan, and, you know, did much all throughout his estimable career to build up the Afghan Ministry of Education's ability to provide, you know, education and then degrees for young people. And he used the word enraging. He said it's enraging to see what is happening to Afghanistan. You know, over the past 20 years, when an illegal war was waged against Afghanistan, moving it now to the point where economic sanctions can drive it into a total economic collapse. And so, you know, for people who care about Afghans and their futures, some will give of themselves greatly to help Afghans who have newly arrived into our much more secure countries, such as the United States and Canada. But it's very clear that the United States government and the United States military, the Pentagon, are more than ready to shift the expenses for bringing people to a safer haven in the United States to very ordinary civilians. The Pentagon has asked in the United States for upwards of $740 billion for next year. And yet they're not the ones who are going to assume the expenses for trying to cope with the consequences of their horrible 20 years of warfare in Afghanistan. You're going to find that people, you know, living on their social security checks and whatever meager savings they have are going to be dipping into their pockets while also, you know, being part of the taxation system in the United States. And they'll be the ones trying to say, well, maybe we can find housing and we can form a group of five and that we can be shareholders and then we can get one person to safety. And then we'll be the ones responsible if that person has a dental bill or a hospital bill or education bills. So this to me seems to be terribly unfair. And the other thing is that the United States has moved so quickly to say, okay, we're done with that war. We're ready for the next one. You know, instead of pausing and looking at the consequences of the war and asking, you know, we waged a war of choice. What responsibility, what accountability do we have? Instead, the United States, so driven by military contractors who profit from making weapons, has been saying to the United States public, we have to spend more money and update our weapons, make them more sophisticated. Our drone technology isn't enough. Our drone attacks aren't enough to enable us to go to war, for instance, with China. We've been losing the war games that these experts conduct, and so we have to get better, more sophisticated weapons. And even one United States Admiral Charles Richard said, in the event of a military engagement with China, recourse to nuclear weapons would become a probability, not a possibility. Now, I think we have to listen to that with very acute attention, crossing into the nuclear threshold, basically, recognizing that China might have capacities that could so far outpace the United States' capacities that the one arrow in their pack that they have is a nuclear weapon. And meanwhile, the United States has engaged in consistent cover-up and lies regarding the effects of the drone attacks that they have been waging. It becomes so important, Chris, because just days after a suicide bomber had killed himself and killed 13 U.S. Marines and over 170 Afghan civilians at the Hamid Karzai International Airport on August 26th, the United States military, anxious to prevent another attack, yes, and perhaps also promising revenge, spotted a man driving a white Toyota Corolla and followed that man for 8 hours, constantly pulling information from drone camera footage, which they call it confirmation bias, confirmed in their mind a belief that this man was a danger, that this man was operating with ISIS, that this man was likely to make a second attack that could kill more Americans and more Afghans, and he had to be stopped. In that 8-hour process, a civilian named Zamari Ahmad had been packing his bags and readying his family early in the day to go to the United States. He worked for an NGO called Nutrition Education International based in California. Because he had worked with them for 6 years, he was eligible to go to the United States. And he drove the company car. And so on his last day in Kabul, he was doing errands. He was picking up his boss's computer. He was making sure that his own family would get canisters of water that were desperately needed because there's a drought and it's hard to get clean water. And so he had loaded canisters of water in the trunk of his car while the U.S. military analysts were concluding, oh, that's certainly someone loading more explosives. Look how gingerly they're handling those containers. He was carrying a black computer bag, and they concluded that's what these ISIS operatives tend to carry. He was driving into his own family's driveway, and the family had a tradition of all the kids coming out, and he would let the oldest son or one of the older sons park the car after he pulled up. And so the kids were coming outside for this event, and that's when, even though a child was visible on the screen, they decided to fire from a Reaper drone a Hellfire missile that killed 10 members, that killed Zamari Ahmadi and 10 members of his family, including 3 toddlers. General Morley said that was a righteous event. And then later, they acknowledged, oh, he wasn't any kind of an ISIS operative. But still, the United States military conclusion from General Sami Said was no wrongdoing was done. And so we're saying, don't look away from what happened to that family. They're still stuck in Afghanistan. They haven't been given any conclusive word about getting out or getting money. And they're in danger because they did work with Westerners.
It reminds me of the collateral murder, of course, the video that WikiLeaks released in Iraq so long ago. And on the way out, it seems almost as a tribute to the U.S. military complex that Joe Biden promised $10 billion to the Air Force to conduct these over-the-horizon attacks, which what you describe is perfectly fits into that. These distant attacks from drones where information gleaned from these cameras from thousands of feet in the air are interpreted and tragically misinterpreted. 90% of the people killed, according to Daniel Hale, who sits in prison in the United States for whistleblowing, kill people that have nothing to do with what the stated aims of the attack are.
You know, I think of that UNHCR worker in Islamabad who said, you know, keep Afghanistan in the news. And fortunately, I mean, for instance, the New York Times did publish the 5 years worth of research by a woman named Asmat Khan, which showed exactly what Daniel Hale had revealed. Now, Daniel Hale is serving 4 years in the Marion Federal Penitentiary, very punitive years, because he did what he believed had to be done. He said to the judge, I stole a government document because I could no longer steal what was not mine to take, the lives of innocent people. And so it's certainly true. Andrew Coburn has demonstrated that no matter how sophisticated this drone technology gets to be, unless it's a completely clear day and they're flying at a low altitude, cars appear like blotches and human beings can't be distinguished one from another. And so the United States has not only not been willing to acknowledge this failure in their technology to make any distinction between civilians and combatants again and again, they also now are pushing the U.S. people to be fearful and create new technology, which is really kind of a software upgrade away from completely autonomous drone operations, no human being involved. And, you know, again, I when we think about the faultiness, there are plenty of people who are desperate in places like Afghanistan, and they get into rivalries and gangs often, and they have enemies, and, what's a good way to get rid of your enemy? Tell the United States military that your enemy is their enemy. And that's part of how they get this faulty information. People turn other people in because they've got a feud or a rivalry or they're afraid of what the other person might do to them. It's sordid, but it's what can be predicted when all of your activity in another country has been related to a network of military bases. And unfortunately, the U.S. was highly, highly dependent on military bases and military intelligence and CIA intelligence and paid informants. And none of that kind of financial wheeling and dealing translated into assistance for women and children. 75% of the country are women and children.
Well, it's almost as if the last 20 years never happened when you see Guantanamo Bay, the prison filled with people that were turned in, just as you described, by people, not because that they were involved in any terrorist activity, but because they were rivals and their rivals were quicker or smarter, more smarter and quicker than they were. I bladed the Western press in the introduction. There is a report from a few days ago in the New York Times by Christina Goldbaum and Yaqub Akbari. They write, over 1 million flee as Afghanistan's economy collapses. They've got numbers of 4,000 to 5,000 Afghans per day are trying to flee the country into Iran alone, and more than a million have left the country since last October. Again, before I contacted you, Kathy, a friend had written and asked if I knew of any way that people could, give small donations to aid Afghanistan. Ones that were, not going to end up being intercepted by the state or siphoned off by scammers or whatever. What do we do now? Can I answer that question for him, or can you answer that question for him? How do people over here help?
Well, the United Nations has formed an escrow account and is trying to get aid into Afghanistan, and I think that's important. And others have been accepting small donations, and then through Western Union or MoneyGram, trying to get them to some of the people on a list of about 100 people who have been people I've known well. I don't recommend sending money to anyone you don't either know personally or is a known friend of a friend. So that network can continue very informally. Pressure has to be placed on the United States government to unfreeze the assets, and also I know it's difficult for the neighboring countries to contemplate, well, what are we going to do, if suddenly maybe civil war breaks out in Afghanistan and people, race to the borders and we're flooded with an influx of new refugees. We can't handle this. The United States waged a war of choice, and we should be assisting the Pakistani government, for instance, and the Iranian government to deal with the refugee crisis, because it is great and it will become probably greater. For those who go to Pakistan right now, if they enter the country illegally, then they can't leave. I mean, they won't be able to leave the country because they never had the paperwork that said that they had legally entered. They might, in fact, be deported back to Afghanistan. And so people are very, very frightened. And, conditions in Pakistan are quite primitive and difficult, particularly in neighborhoods where there's high unemployment. And people who go to Pakistan can't get employment. They're not allowed because they don't have papers. And in Iran, we hear stories again and again of people trying to get across the borders and then being sent back. And, people are desperate. They're hungry and they don't know what else to do. So this is a terrible, terrible situation, which I lay at the door of the United States for having gone to war, an illegal war, for 20 years, and we have to become accountable. Reparations should be paid. So I do encourage people to find some way themselves personally to more or less make reparations. We've got a network of buddies, for instance, and we ask people to team up with young people who are in desperate straits and need encouragement and need help with research and need someone to say we care about you. So that's something I would welcome people to get in touch with us about. It's perfectly fine to contact me. It's my email is Kathy, kathy.vcnv@gmail.com. Meanwhile, I think whatever organizations people are already in touch with, whether it's Veterans for Peace or Women Against War or World Beyond War, let those organizations know this is a high priority and we want to continue being part of an organization that is addressing this issue.
Well, again, and in that New York Times piece, Christina Goldbaum, she says that in Europe, they fear a, quote, deluge of immigrants from Afghanistan, as happened in 2015. But at the same time, Western aid is stymied, she says, by the sanctions, the United States sanctions. So European countries feel that they can't contribute right now. I watched in preparation for this, Kathy, an interview you did some months back with Democracy Now! And in it, you quote Abraham Heschel, and you say some are to blame, all are accountable. Well, I think that can be broadly interpreted that we are all accountable to what happens to people all around the world, and especially if they're victimized by our governments, as the people in Afghanistan were victimized by the Canadian government and all the NATO governments and the United States too, of course. Kathy, before we go, can you please reiterate your contact email so those desperate to try to help but not knowing how can get more information?
Well, thank you. My name is spelled with a K, Kathy vcnv@gmail.com.
Kathy, it's always a joy to speak with you, even though the conditions of our discussions are never bright. But I do look forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for all the preparation you do for the study that you share with us. Thank you.
And I want everyone else to stick around because I'm going to be back after the break with Ivan Kechanovsky, and we're going to talk about what's going on in Ukraine. And that's a whole nother kettle of fish, but somehow it smells the same. Thanks again. Well, I gotta think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio, every Thursday and Saturday at CFUV 101.9 FM. You're not alone.
Ideas and perspectives of the program's host, not that of CFUV or its staff.
And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, American and Canadian efforts to bring diplomatic and military pressure to bear on Russia over Ukraine may seem a mystery to those in the West who rarely receive content with their newspaper or as part of their nightly newscasts. But we're still in the dearth of factual background information on critical issues available to readers and viewers from the media. The analysts and opinion makers presented here more often than not represent those that profit most from the modern warfare economy. For those persevering, though, it is possible to glean sense from the chaos and even sometimes discern the hand behind the mayhem. Ivan Kechanovsky is a scholar, essayist, and author teaching at the School of Political Studies at the University of Ottawa. He's the author of Cleft Countries, Regional Political Divisions and Cultures in Post-Soviet Ukraine and Moldova, and co-authored the books Historical Dictionary of Ukraine, the second edition, and The Paradox of American Unionism, Why Americans Like Unions More Than Canadians Do But Join Much Less. His articles feature at CanadianDimension.com, where his recent piece, The Hidden Origin of the Escalating Ukraine-Russia Conflict, appears. Welcome to the program, Ivan.
Thank you for the invitation.
It's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Ivan, back in 2014, we watched the Maidan Revolution unfold on our television sets. What did we in the West miss then?
I think everything which was the most important and I researched this massacre taking place, and which led to overthrow of the Ukrainian government, which was relatively pro-Russian and also led to the Russian annexation of Crimea and to the civil war in Donbass, to Russian military interventions in Donbass and Crimea, and also to the escalating conflict between Russia and Ukraine, which is now in a very dangerous state. And according to all the revelations which I examined in my studies, which are published in peer-reviewed journals, in academic books, also in presented in major conferences in Canada and the United States. All this evidence suggests actually and shows beyond any doubt that actually this massacre which took place in on February 20th, 2014 was organized and perpetrated by not by the government forces or government snipers or government police units, as was presented by the media and by the politicians and by the governments in Ukraine and also in the West, but it was conducted with involvement of far-right elements and also oligarchic elements of the Maidan opposition and leadership in particular, and also there is evidence of involvement of foreign snipers from Georgia who admitted publicly about their involvement and the involvement of other snipers. And this is actually what's most important, misrepresentation or fake news, because it had very significant effects. Because narrative which was presented by the media, in particular in the West, including top media like the New York Times and Washington Post and Globe and Mail and so on, in many other media outlets and government officials and politicians, was that this was actually peaceful protest. It was democratic movement against the corrupt government, and which led to basically a peaceful change of the Ukrainian government after the former then president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, fled from his position as president of Ukraine and left Ukraine altogether. But all this evidence, actually, all the evidence which I examined suggests this was basically a fake misrepresentation. It was either done because of ignorance or because of just following political motivations, or was done as deliberate misrepresentation of all the evidence. Since then, there were, for instance, confessions by 13 members of Maidan sniper units that suggest and confess of their own involvement in the massacre of the police, which took place at the same time as massacre of the protesters, took place on Maidan, but also several of them revealed also involvement of the Maidan snipers in the massacre of the Maidan protesters in order to implicate the government or government forces. And this was done in media interviews, in Ukrainian media interviews in particular, and in BBC interview and in other venues, for instance, in confessions to Maidan investigation in Ukraine, which was leaked and published by a Ukrainian blogger who lives in Spain. And this kind of confessions basically show that members of far-right link sniper groups, in particular from Svoboda, a far-right party which was originally organized as neo-Nazi Social National Party in Ukraine, and was one of the founding members of Maidan movement. Actually, they were involved in this massacre of the police. They started this massacre of the police, and they confessed about this openly to in Ukrainian media, to BBC interviews, and they also confessed that they have also done this. They did their organization violence and this basically massacre against police with involvement of another far-right organization, Right Sector. And this confessions basically did not result in any convictions, in nothing at all. They are basically omitted.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ivan Kachanovsky. Ivan's a scholar. He's an essayist. He's an author. He's teaching at the School of Political Studies at the University of Ottawa. We're talking today about his article that appears in CanadianDimension.com, The Hidden Origin of the Escalating Ukraine-Russia Conflict. Well, Ivan, you make a strong case and repeatedly that this the provenance of the snipers and the murders and the massacre at the Maidan Square in 2014, which led to the fall of the Ukraine government and the rise of the Western-friendly government in Kiev that exists to this day. It's pretty clear, and there was a lot of there were similar events in other countries where snipers were employed by forces or hands unknown to shoot both sides of these conflicts to create chaos in what began as peaceful demonstrations. It looks very much like that, and your long investigation seems to confirm that that is what happened indeed in the Maidan Square. So what is the pertinence of that fact? What does it mean for the course of Ukraine since? And why, as you write in your article, do you feel that the most dangerous phase of the Russia-Ukraine contretemps is right now?
I think this is has a very crucial evidence and implications for all the conflicts which took place in Ukraine since this massacre. Because, as I mentioned it, and according to my own research, and I specialize in political violence in Ukraine since I wrote a dissertation, my dissertation on this topic, which you mentioned, which was published as a book called 12 Countries and Compared Violent Conflicts and also Regional Divisions in Ukraine, and Moldova. And this kind of massacre, basically, with the involvement of far-right leaders and members, and also oligarchic members of Maidan leadership, and involvement of foreign snipers, actually suggests that actually this conflict started, and the main responsibility for the start of this conflict actually is not by the Yanukovych and his government, which was publicly blamed.
That much is clear. So what are the ramifications of that?
Yeah, so this basically means that Western governments and the media and politicians and a variety of others, like public personalities, basically supported the either wittingly or unwittingly. And now, because of all the evidence available, it would be difficult to deny this, that they basically supported not a democratic and peaceful overthrow of the government, which massacred Maidan protesters, but they actually supported violent and undemocratic overthrow of the Ukrainian government, and that this is a kind of because of ignorance, but I think this was also done. And the question is, what can actually they knew about this? Because now there is no way to deny that this evidence does not exist. It's publicly available and so on, but still people pretend and say that this was kind of peaceful transition. So in this case, people who actually were presented as Democrats, basically, and kind of the ones who were kind of our heroes, actually in Ukraine, actually the ones who basically committed mass murder. So they actually, and they are celebrated as people who brought a new Ukraine and who overthrew kind of the government and so on, and became victims of this conflict with Russia and defenders of Ukraine, but actually they are the ones who actually have a responsibility for this, and not only political responsibility, but also this will be require basically criminal responsibility, and supporting such overthrow. This actually kind of just tells that Western governments and politicians and the media, they do not care very much about Ukraine. They are mostly concerned about actually kind of using Ukraine against Russia, because this conflict also led to the escalating conflict between Ukraine and Russia, which has now become very dangerous for the Ukraine future, because nobody is persecuted for any, nobody is actually under arrest right now or been convicted for any murder which took place during the Maidan massacre. So and this includes police and protesters, and this is also kind of very important, because origin of this conflict is very crucial to understand what happened in Ukraine afterwards, and who actually has the main responsibility for the start of this conflict. And this is now clear according to my research. But if you look into the media reports or kind of political statements, this is complete omission. So this is like basically a taboo topic, or even fake news about actually who was responsible for this mass murder. So it's like, for me, this is like Orwell kind of situation with Orwell 1984 in his famous book, but instead of 1984, we have 2011, and this still continues of Crimea. So this is actually a very important issue and central issue to understanding Ukrainian conflict and who was actually bears kind of responsibility for start of this conflict. So that's why implications are just enormous.
Well, and what we saw in 2014 and prior to the Maidan, what's been called the Maidan Revolution at Maidan Square, Victoria Nuland, the current undersecretary at the State Department, was involved in setting the stage for that coup and who would succeed and take power in Ukraine. And now Victoria Nuland is back. That was under the Obama administration. Now she's back with the Biden administration. And again, Ukraine falls under her purview. What role did Victoria Nuland play and the neocons that she represents in what we see going on in Ukraine right now?
My research does not focus on specific individuals, so I do not have any evidence about like specific politicians, like Western politicians involved and so on. But this very interesting revelation in a book by Ukrainian journalists, and they mention that some unnamed Western politician met with leaders of Maidan, including from the Svoboda Farai Party, a few weeks before the Maidan massacre. And this Western representative, or Western government representative, told them that just few protesters who were killed at the time, this was not sufficient for the Western governments to stop basically recognizing the Yanukovych government, and that it was necessary to have 100 protesters killed, or to have 100 victims among Maidan protesters for the Western governments to do this. And they basically described this as basically as kind of just arguing how many people have to be victims in order to for Western governments to change their policies of Yanukovych government. And they discussed like 10, 20 and so on, and they stopped at 100. And this is what happened. And after the Maidan massacre, there was a public announcement by the Maidan leaders and the media, in the media, that there was 700 in of Maidan massacre victims, and they kind of included often also victims among government kind of supporters or people who were just not related to Maidan protests, in order to inflate this number to 100. And after this, immediately Western governments stopped basically recognizing Yanukovych, and Biden stated in his memoir that he told Yanukovych basically to leave his kind of presidency and to leave Ukraine, because he immediately blamed Yanukovych for this massacre. So I think it's necessary for the Western governments to open their kind of evidence that they have what happened actually during this time and who actually was responsible, because I think it's almost zero possibility that they do not know actually who was actually responsible for this massacre. They should have all this evidence, but it's not made public. So I think they need to come clean about this crucial event, which is still is misrepresented and still very dangerous, because without actually understanding who was responsible for Maidan massacre and also prosecuting them and revealing them, and making and naming names and so on, it would be not possible for the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, and also conflict in Ukraine, in Donbass and other places in Ukraine to be resolved peacefully. So that's why this is a very crucial issue.
Well, I think there's a zero chance that the current administration in the United States is going to investigate further what happened in the Maidan, especially considering that their own people were involved in it even way back then. You write in your article, and again, it's at CanadianDimensions.com, the hidden origin of the escalating Ukraine-Russia conflict. You write that, various hawks care little about the potentially disastrous consequences of an escalation of armed hostilities for Ukraine and ordinary Ukrainians. I would argue, too, for the broader world beyond.
The U.S. administration, they use Ukraine and they regard Ukraine only as a tool against Russia, to contain Russia. So that's why they care a little about consequences for Ukraine, what happened with Ukraine and ordinary Ukrainians in case of a conflict becoming a violent conflict or turning into war between Ukraine and Russia, which will be totally devastating for Ukraine, and would have very negative consequences for many Ukrainians. But for them, this is just politics, geopolitics. And also, I am in this interesting statement by Blinken about the Maidan massacre. He said in one of his media interviews that our statements which he made, that when he visited Maidan after the Maidan massacre, he said that there were snipers located in buildings which surrounded Maidan, and protesters were killed by snipers from those buildings. And now Ukrainian government investigation says this is basically fake news. Ukrainian government investigation says there were no snipers at all in any of the buildings, in particular the ones which were controlled by the Maidan forces. And they also say that government snipers also were not responsible for the massacre, that they arrived later and so on, according to my own research, similar to my own research, with one exception, but this is just a late exception, and this is also not supported by any evidence. And now you have a statement basically by a senior representative of the U.S. government saying something about the Maidan massacre which is totally incompatible with Ukrainian government investigation about this massacre, and there are no questions asked, no media kind of interviews, nothing, no issues raised. This is just kind of is just accepted or brushed away as totally unimportant. Even so, top U.S. government officials basically says that there were snipers in the Maidan, and nobody cares actually who were they, kind of about their identity, about their persecution. Even so, Ukrainian government investigation now blankly denies that there were any snipers. Even so, there are videos of them, the audio recordings of them, there is evidence from forensic government investigations by forensic experts who actually found that absolute majority of protesters were shot not from the front and from horizontal positions, from the police direction in on the ground, but they were shot actually from very steep directions, and most wounds, absolute majority of wounds were in the back and in the side, left or right side.
Right. You also say in your article, you say that according to the American position, this is how they lay it out. The pro-Russian government of Viktor Yanukovych was ousted by peaceful protesters in 2014, and then dozens of them were massacred by government snipers. Now, you say that didn't happen. They go on to say the American position is Russia annexed Crimea and launched a hybrid war with Ukraine in the Donbass with the help of Russian proxies, and they never fail to call the people of eastern Ukraine Russian-sponsored. But you say there's a counter-narrative to this, and you say it's from the Russians, but many others too, that says the Ukrainian government was overthrown in a fascist putsch, which led to Crimea voluntarily joining Russia and to a civil war without Russian military involvement in the Donbass. They say the Ukraine has been under de facto NATO rule since 2014 and regard unrecognized separatist republics in the Donbass as independent. I would say that second narrative is pretty much what I believe happened and seems correct to me. But you say neither the American narrative nor the one that I just elucidated are accurate. How is that Russian narrative inaccurate?
Yes, because I study all these events, I specialize in these issues, and I extensively studied all these events taking place, and I still do this. And I can say that according to my research and studies by absolute majority of other scholars who research this conflicts, actually there was no kind of far-right or fascist coup taking place in Ukraine, because this was done not only by far-right, but there was key and very crucial involvement of far-right in this overthrow of the government, but this was done also with involvement of oligarchic elements of Maidan leadership. So this was done with opposition, which was not far-right, but also this was done with involvement of foreign kind of snipers and possibly involvement of foreign countries, which is issue still a big issue, actually, if this was just regime change, which was led by the United States government, or if this was organized by elements of kind of Maidan leadership, oligarchic elements of Maidan leadership. In addition to this, I also examined Crimea. In Crimea, there was a very strong support for separatism even before the Maidan massacre and Maidan events, and this became overwhelming support for separatism in joining Russia after the violent overthrow of the Russian government. But this was not done by Crimeans, even so they supported this voluntarily. Joining Russia, absolute majority of them, this crucial role was Russian military intervention in Crimea, because Russia deployed green men, so-called green men, who actually were able to take control over Crimea from the Ukrainian forces. And even so, there were Russian military already stationed, specifically Navy stationed in Sevastopol city. Russian military intervention was not limited to the city. It was kind of limited, also contained other parts of Crimea. So this was, according to legal definitions, this was annexation. Even so, absolute majority of people in Crimea supported this joining Russia.
Crimea is a big part of the Western narrative, and the fact that it has never failed to be regarded as an annexation by Russia. The counter-narrative says that it wasn't annexation, that this was a voluntary move. So are you saying that it's some kind of hybrid between annexation and a voluntary move via referendum, that the Russians were indeed manipulating this this situation there?
Yeah, according to my research, this was done with absolute majority of Crimeans supported joining Russia, and that's why they welcome Russian annexation. But according to a legal definition, this is a political science definition, this was done against international law, which requires kind of agreement of the country. And for a specific region not to secede, and this was, as far according to legal definition, political science definition, this was annexation. But I mentioned about this because I wrote about this because there was similar Kosovo precedent taking place in former Yugoslavia, which also led to unilateral secession of Kosovo. In addition to this, also Russian claims that this is just a pure civil war, without any Russian military intervention or involvement in Donbass, is also not supported by my research and by my evidence, because there is clear evidence of direct Russian military interventions in the kind of in August of 2014 in Donbass, and in winter of 2015 when Russia deployed covertly several battalions. Or a few battalions, maybe a few thousand people, military in Donbass, in order to support separatists, local separatists, and I guess Ukrainian military forces and far-right led paramilitary battalions, which were actually trying to take control over separatist controlled part of Donbass. And according to my research, still Russia, there are no Russian troops or regular units right now in Donbass, and Russia basically withdrew most of their forces after these interventions, shortly after these military interventions in August 2015 and winter 2015. And absolute majority of members of so-called DNR and LNR republics are local members. They are local population.
Well, Ivan, we're fast running out of time. You end your essay saying that without understanding the Maidan massacre and bringing to justice its perpetrators, it's impossible to understand and resolve peacefully the internal and international conflicts involving Ukraine and this dangerously escalating war in the Donbass, and maybe spreading into Russia as well. I want to thank you, Ivan Kachanovsky, for coming on and telling us a little about this tonight, eh?
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, my great pleasure, and I want to also thank Kathy Kelly and all the good folks that keep the wheel spinning up here week in and week out. I want you to stay tuned because you know that there's great programming coming up, but that's all I've got for this time. Until the next time.
I'm Kajal, and I work at the UVSS Food Bank and Free Store. We are excited to announce that we are back up and running in the food bank, located in the basement of the sub, room B005. All undergraduate students at UVic are able to access the food bank once every week. All you have to do is sign up in advance online at uvss.ca/foodbank. I've been